The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome, everyone, again to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt, and again today, as every week, I'll be taking you out to the big picture, in to the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those, of course, rich with the essence of constant renewal. It is a pleasure to be back with you again today, and I must say at the top that amidst all of our conversations that we have been having here over the last year, those about the coming era of extraordinary change, those about the economy, energy, and the environment, those about the mix of systemic breakdowns, surprises, and breakthroughs, all contributing to shocks we are experiencing and likely to see more of, perhaps no show may be as important as today's. Because with all the change we have been talking about and all the needs we have been pointing to in terms of the economic and financial system reform, in terms of the energy innovation, in terms of one planet living that we have been putting into our sites of discussion, all must include the participation of government and Congress in particular with legislation to support desirable futures. But in the words of my distinguished guest today, Dr. Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation for Ethics and professor of law at Harvard, in his words, our democracy is in crisis. Special interest money dominates Washington, creating the impression that votes in Congress are bought and sold with millions of dollars in campaign cash. Our conversation today with Larry will illustrate, I think, this connection between special interest money and critical policy decisions, and I think it's going to explain why promises of reform have gone nowhere. And just as importantly, because our attention on Zoomed is directed, as you know, to both understanding and to action, we will be talking about the need for a movement of people, a way forward that brings together citizens of all backgrounds who are fed up with the economy of influence in Washington. We are going to discuss what such a movement looks like. Larry is going to begin to help us shape how it will finally achieve an electoral system in which our leaders are accountable to no one but the people. So all of you, I think especially regular listeners to Zoom, know that I have a great deal of passion and feel a great deal about regaining sovereignty over issues of the commons and those issues central to our futures. And nowhere, perhaps, is the diminishment of this sovereignty as visible as it is with lobbyists continuing today to weaken the financial reform bill going on in Congress. And I think Larry can speak more to this, but what I'm able to see is the banking assault on the bill is rolling in. And just this week, as I was reading last night on maplight.org, the latest lobbyist victory, a 35-60 defeat of an amendment that would allow states to cap interest rates to protect citizens from usurious credit lenders. Senators who voted against this bill, and this, I think, is part of our conversation today, they received 144% more money than those who voted to protect consumers. And this, I suspect, is just a tip of the iceberg and not even the best example. It isn't, in my view, a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. It is, as I think Larry will describe so well and has pointed to so clearly, it is a fundamental question of what kind of democracy we want to have. Last week, Professor Lessig spoke to these issues at a lecture in Dartmouth. That lecture was entitled Rebooting Our Democracy. I think that's really a great link and a compliment to what I have really targeted this show in terms of our focus, fix Congress first. And by way of further introduction, Larry's work addresses institutional corruption, relationships which are legal, even currently ethical, but which weaken public trust in institutions. He's the author of quite an array of books, Remix, Free Culture, Future of Ideas, and so many awards I could go on that could be summed up. I think he's one of the top American visionaries we have here in America. Larry, great to have you on Zoom here. What a conversation to have with you.
I'm very happy to be here.
Maybe we can start. I've really felt it in your writings, Larry, the poignancy, the directness, but maybe start with our listeners about why fix Congress first.
Well, I think what many people are recognizing is that regardless of the issue that you really care about, whether it's global warming, health care, reform of the financial services sector, it doesn't matter. Any of those issues is going to face fundamental block of reform until we address an underlying problem which makes it impossible for our current Congress to actually do what the people want as opposed to what their funders want. And so what we've tried to get people to see is that all of this reform effort on particular issues is wasted until we can address this more fundamental problem first. So what Fix Congress First is, in its name and in its work, trying to do is to get people to focus on this more fundamental root cause of our problems here in this democracy and try to do something about it.
Well, I think that's a great start on it, Larry. And I was pointing to the financial system reform and some of that legislation just to get started. I wonder if you can even say some more about, so where are we and how do we actually live with this? What's going on? How does this actually play out in reality? I mean, what is it that you're seeing and the base of this for our listeners to get a better handle on?
I think what we've seen, we've actually seen repeatedly, and we'll see more of as this administration goes on. You know, you'll have a proposal for some substantial reform. For example, take the healthcare reform that has components that are strongly supported by constituents of members of Congress, but which are strongly opposed by large funders of campaigns of members of Congress. And so Congress has a choice between following the interests of their constituents or following the interests of the funders. And what we've seen in the current environment of fundraising is that they can't afford to ignore the interests of their funders, so they find ways of blocking or misdirecting the reform so that it does what the funders want as opposed to what the citizens want. You know, there's that happening global warming legislation, which, of course, has not yet been voted on, but has been slowed because of exactly this dynamic. It's happening in financial reform, happening with the Consumer Financial Protection Agency Act. All of these are changes which affect a very powerful interest pretty directly, and so the interest uses all of its resources to block or redirect the reform so that it benefits not the constituents, but benefits those interests.
So maybe, Larry, we've got a pretty good international audience here, some of which may not be as familiar with the way these campaigns actually operate. Why is it that our Congress folks are so attuned to the money in this case? I mean, can you really say a little bit more about that, paint that picture? Because that seems to be a pretty rich one as a context here.
Yeah, well, you know, essentially what happened in the United States politics is that in the early 1990s, it became possible for the Republicans to imagine taking control of our governments in the House and the Senate for the first time in 40 years. And when Newt Gingrich succeeded in gaining control of the House, the Republicans got a taste for being in the majority, and the Democrats got a taste for being in the minority. And both of those tastes created a very strong incentive for both parties to fight hard to try to regain majority status. So that upped the ante of what was at stake in these elections as Congress was teetering between being a Democratic-controlled institution or a Republican-controlled institution. At the same time, the costs of advertising were going through the roof because the FCC had backed away from requirements that effectively kept the cost of political advertisement low. So just at the time that there was stronger need to raise money, the need got even worse because the cost of campaigns went up. So this began a process which is wonderfully described in a great book by Robert Kaiser called So Damn Much Money. It began a process of enormous competition within Congress to raise amounts of money that just had never been seen before in order to run these campaigns to get either a member reelected or to get a party back in control. And as that pressure developed to raise more and more money, norms that used to restrain Congress, that used to keep it within some decent boundaries, began to disappear. So my favorite example is, again, quoted by Robert Kaiser, Senator Stennis, John Stennis from Mississippi, in the early 1980s was head of the Armed Services Committee. And he was asked by a colleague to have a fundraiser for defense contractors. And Stennis responded, would that be proper? He said, I hold life and death in these companies. It wouldn't be proper for me to raise money from them. Now, the ethic that Stennis described is wholly alien to the current Congress because, of course, everybody in a position of power, especially head of a committee like the Armed Services Committee, recognizes that they need to leverage that power into fundraising. And so that's, in fact, what they do. And so this begins to create this very corrupting influence of the regulators raising money from the people they're regulating, and obviously in the context of that exchange, much less than efficient or effective regulation gets produced.
Well, and Larry, we've only got about a minute and a half in this opening segment here, but just for our listeners, what's the sense of the money we're talking about? How much is involved for a congressman or a senator in terms of their campaigns and the contributions that are coming in from these large donors?
Well, the total amount of money that was raised and spent in the 2008 election was about $1.4 billion. And in contested seats, it could be anywhere from $1 million to $3 million to win an election. The donors, you know, obviously their individual donors are capped, but what lobbyists effectively do is bundle a whole bunch of large donors so that they can walk in representing hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations, even though they're just bundling together $2,400 donations from any individual. So it turns out the money doesn't seem to be a lot in any individual context, but the competition is so great that they will pay attention to and yield to any large amount of money because they need it to win their election.
Well, and so that I think that starts to make it more clear about the context that we're describing here. Larry, I know we're coming up on a break. I can hear the music in the background in our ear here. Let's take a short pause. I'd love to continue with this because I think flushing this, understanding this more clearly will help us understand and build upon how we got here and a picture into where we might go and go forward. Listeners, take a short break here. Professor Lawrence Lessig here, professor at Harvard, professor and director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation for Ethics. Come back in a minute. I think our conversation is going to deepen and evolve greatly. Come back in a minute. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880 or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Here we are on Zoomed on this Monday. We are back. Fix Congress first. Our focus, rebooting our democracy, our emphasis. And our guest, Larry Lessig, and we're talking about all this and building the context of it. And Larry, in our first segment, we started to paint, I think, the picture around it and started to get some more specifics and make this tangible and real for us. Maybe you can help us get a little handle on this and even more clarity about some examples of this, some of the issues, how this has played out, how this has evolved, to even ground it more clearly for our listeners.
Well, I think that, what has happened is that people who believe that the system has to be lived with, which increasingly includes, I think, the president, have recognized that in the current political environment, the way you get things done is you buy off the interests who are most strongly opposed to what you might want to get done. So, again, think about healthcare. A lot of very creative proposals about how to deal with healthcare policy problems were on the table as this administration came to power. But its first step in getting health care bill passed was to sit down with the pharmaceutical industry and strike a deal so that we would basically pay resale prices for any wholesale drugs the United States bought. And then number two, sit down with the insurance industry, and as we've subsequently come to discover, assure them that there would be no independent public option that would be in the final bill that would create enormous competition for them to keep the cost of insurance down. Those two deals were struck so that it was possible to go forward and get the support necessary to pass the bill. And from the perspective of, just good political strategy, you can say that was pretty good because they did get health care. But from the perspective of the way our democracy functions, it's enormously troubling that that the thing that was most important was not what voters ultimately cared about, but was instead the financial power of industry to leverage money into the political system and thereby control how members of Congress were going to be voting. And, there's a thousand examples like that, but I think that's the most dramatic of the recent cycle.
Well, it is. And so let me just play this back, though. What I'm hearing then is we're really attuning to the interests of the two corporate groups you're describing there as a precedent to the interest of the people and the sovereignty of what individuals and collectively we might want. I mean, it's really prioritizing this, and the money has that kind of a prioritizing influence. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. And it happens sometimes at the most prominent level, like with healthcare, but it happens many more, much more frequently, in just under the cover issues, where the press or nobody's paying much attention to what the issue is, and lobbyists find a very easy way to reward one of their clients, and do that by channeling or facilitating large amounts of contributions to members of Congress, never directly, because, of course, that's a crime, but through the very elaborate dance that members in Congress learn to play. There's a great quote by Congressman, it's my own congressman, so let me just not name him until I can look at my notes to make sure. But the quote is basically, in Washington's the sort of city where you never write if you can call, and you never call if you can speak, and you never speak if you can nod, and you never nod if you can wink. And the basic intuition there is you constantly communicate in the way that leaves the least trace, the least thing in response, and that's obviously because it makes it much easier to strike deals that, if everybody saw what the deals were, nobody would be very excited about it.
Well, you know, what you're describing here is that sort of subtlety about it, and I was very tuned in to the video that came out, and the Massachusetts junior senator, Scott Brown, I guess last month was being asked by the press why he was voting against or was not in favor of the financial reform, and it wasn't a matter of him even being able to be clear about why. It was just no. I mean, that was just quite an amazing exchange there, Larry. Is that not sort of indicative of this? That there's just the impression of, no, you're against it because that's the direction you're getting?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, these guys are very busy, but they don't actually have enough time to focus on what they're there to do because they spend such an enormous amount of time raising money. For example, you know, the estimates that we've seen are anywhere from 30 to 70% of their time raising money, meaning sitting in a cubicle with a headset on, dialing one number after another of people they've never even met, asking them to give money to support themselves or to support their party to get into office. You know, if you're spending all of that amount of time basically trying to guarantee that you get back into office, you're not going to have a lot of time to do things like attend committee hearings or to read bills. And, you know, we need to really ask, if we've got a Congress that, let's take the conservative estimate, is spending just 40% of their time raising money and only 60% of the time doing their job, do we have a Congress that's a full-time Congress that's addressing, obviously, issues that require full-time attention?
Well, issues that are quite complex as we become an increasingly interdependent world. But Larry, I'm curious about how we got here. I mean, I think our listeners also know, and we've had it just alluded to in some other conversations, about the Supreme Court decision giving even more capacity for corporations to donate money and be involved in this. How has this actually progressed to where we are now?
Well, I think, you know, the issue in the Supreme Court case, the Citizens United case, was whether Congress had the power consistent with the First Amendment to limit the ability of corporations 60 days before an election to spend corporate funds on behalf of a candidate. And what the court held was that the First Amendment forbids Congress from restricting speech like that because the court believes that that kind of restriction is precisely the kind of restriction that the First Amendment was trying to avoid. Now, the problem with the decision isn't so much that it's concerned about protecting the free speech rights of companies or anybody else, aliens or dolphins for that matter. The problem is that it creates a situation where it's almost impossible now to have an election where the people can believe that it's something other than money that's driving the result in the election. Because as an enormous amount of money enters into this political system, more and more people are going to confirm what they already have an intuition about, that it's not really the votes that are mattering, it's more what they have to do to get the money to get into office. And that produces the kind of cynicism and disengagement that I think we're seeing endemic with the United States Congress right now in particular. And so I think that's the real concern about this decision. It's going to make a bad situation much, much worse.
And, Larry, this seems to me to be a real fundamental here, and I think, as I was alluding to in the beginning, some sense of your work about the trust in institutions and, you know, looking at some of the research coming into this show, it looked like the Pew Foundation and the Pew Research that came out a month or two ago really showed that the trust Americans have, both Democrats and Republicans, the trust we have in Congress is an all-time low and staggering proportions in terms of how low. If I recall, it was in the 80% or something like that. That's quite a stark view that we're seeing about people have toward a fundamental institution like this that's going to be so central to the forms of change that we might need.
Yeah, that's right. But again, it's not surprising. You know, as people look at the way we elect members to Congress and look at the way money is so important to members of Congress as they do their job, it's obviously an easy interpretation of anything Congress does that what the Congress did was not based on what was really the right thing to do, but based on what was the best thing to do to preserve access to the money. And even when it's unfair to make that inference, that's what most people will infer. And so the response to that is not to kind of lecture the American public about how they're being unfair. The response to that is to create a system for electing members to Congress that doesn't give such an easy interpretive out to most people when they disagree with what Congress does. We've got to create a system for electing members to Congress that produces independence and integrity and trust, rather than the current system that just produces historically high levels of cynicism and mistrust in that institution.
And is that this not the rub in some ways here too, Larry, that we don't have a lot of trust in the institution, and we're trying to change and really transform the very flow of money itself and those that are influencing it and may not want to actually see that happen? Sounds to me like it's a very interesting intersection here and an important intersection of where we are about how this might actually be generated to make the impact we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're in a position where there's such an enormous amount of anger about the existing system and frustration that, you know, even when you win, you don't seem to win. That's true for both Republicans and Democrats. Republicans who wanted small government didn't get small government when they had a Republican government. And Democrats who want real reform haven't yet seen real reform, even though they've had super majorities in the Senate and the House and a president. So that produces frustration that this basic promise of democracy doesn't seem to be working. And that frustration, I think, is an opportunity to get people to focus on what the underlying problem here is. So the underlying problem is a Congress that's distracted from the thing they're supposed to be concerned about, not how to raise money, how to keep rich contributors happy, but how to answer the demands of their constituents and keep their constituents convinced that Congress's number one concern is serving the people.
Well, you just I think, illuminated maybe the possibility here, the opportunity with this kind of distrust and the community and the electorate really not being so happy with it. And that's what I'd like to really start pointing the attention to here, Larry, is to really get a sense of what opportunity is here and how that might be done. What is the movement that might be embraced to move this forward? But I hear the music in my ears. Let's take a short break, and we'll come back. Larry Lessig, our conversation about fixing Congress first and why, and about rebooting our democracy. That's more of where we're heading. Come back in a minute. Thanks.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now. Toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880, or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind. Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoom Leadership.
Okay, here we are back again on this Monday. Larry Lessig, our guest, professor of law at Harvard, director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation for Ethics, our conversation, rebooting our democracy and focusing on fix Congress first. Larry, we left it last time by really getting to the sense of the opportunity here, and maybe you can start to point to that because there's such an opportunity of movement here that you've been pointing to and writing about, and the momentum and possibility of the Fair Elections Now Act. Maybe we can start to at least point to that and described how this opportunity may be a good one for us.
Well, if the problem that we're facing is a Congress no one trusts because people believe they care more about the money than they care about doing what's right for the constituents, the solution is to make it so that nobody can believe that Congress is acting because of the money. The biggest opportunity we've got right now is a bill that's it's got about 154 co-sponsors in the House at this moment, called the Fair Elections Now Act. And what the Fair Elections Now Act does is gives members an opportunity to opt in to a small dollar contribution model so that members would commit to accepting no more than $100 from any citizen, no money from PACs, nobody else, just $100 from citizens. And when they take $100, the government will match that 4-to-1. So every $100 is worth $500. And with that ratio, members would be able to run competitive, successful campaigns without ever taking any large dollar contributions from anybody. And if we had a Congress that was elected under such a system, then it would be impossible to credibly believe that Congress is making a decision because of money, because, you know, obviously that amount of money is so small that nobody would, you know, make a decision or be interested in making a decision. It was driven just by the money. And that could create the condition, the first steps, for a reestablishment of the kind of trust that this institution needs and so desperately lacks right now. And so I think the real opportunity is if we could just press the Democrats and the Republicans who have supported this bill as well to be bold enough to look for some fundamental reform as opposed to the really puny changes that are being talked about right now to deal with both the Citizens United decision and the ongoing cynicism about how our government works, then we could have a chance to see some meaningful reform. I think that, you know, we are close enough in the House that we could actually pass this bill in the House this year. And if we did that, that would, I think, begin to set a debate for the rest of the country about how we can get a bill like this passed in the House and Senate next cycle.
And so I'm understanding that there's sponsorship. 145 members of the House are sponsoring it. 17 members of the Senate are part of the sponsor on that. But for our listeners here, Larry, can we, you know, paint a picture of what this might look like if we were taking this to our own state, for example, and what this might look like with our own congresswoman, man or woman, and a member of the Senate? What actually might this look like in terms of how that would work? What the amount of money is involved, just to get a tangible sense of how that would be different from what's actually in place right now.
Well, right now, when you run for Congress, you take money from individuals, and those contributions can be up to $2,400 in any cycle. You can take money from PACs, and I believe the current limit on PAC contributions is about $10,000. And you take those contributions you take those contributions, I'm sorry, PAC contributions I think are actually $5,000, but you take those contributions in the largest way that you can so that you can minimize the amount of time you're going to need to worry about raising money. And what the architects of the Fair Elections Now Act did was they said, well, let's just imagine you were just going to take money maxed at $100, and you raise the same kind of money that you typically raise, but you just took the money that you were getting at $100 or more and just thought of it as $100 and imagined us matching that 4-to-1. Would you raise enough money and be able to be competitive? And the answer is absolutely, and that was what then created this formula that said you could get the 4-to-1 match but never take more than $100 from any individual. And I think that what that means is we're all much more equal with respect to our representatives. Nobody's able to stand out in the list of representatives. You know, right now, at a very minimum, large contributions get you access to congresspeople more than small contributions do. And there are some houses, some offices that have made it pretty clear that you're not going to get a meeting with a member unless you've actually contributed to the member. Well, you know, this would change that dynamic pretty importantly, so that no longer would your life depend upon how much you contributed or your position. It would instead depend upon the votes you represent in your district and the interest of your representative in listening to those.
Well, and I can see how that would begin to establish a level of trust and getting back to our word democracy. I mean, I can feel that. And how would that be? How would that actually play out? How would we feel as individual citizens, and what we would be doing different here now too, to really help make this movement really gain the kind of visibility ultimately, and to contribute to this trust building? What would we need to be doing here, Larry?
Well, what we need to do as individuals is to push hard to get this kind of change done. And if the change, you know, if we can get more people to support the change, more members to support the change, then the leadership in the House will begin to see this as an opportunity to really set up a brand of a clean Congress reform. And I think that everybody's looking for that because of the, you know, extraordinary decline in Congress's reputation. So I think that what citizens can do is talk to their congresspeople about supporting this bill. And you can do that easily on our site, fixcongressfirst.org, where we give you, if you're in the Take Action section, a list of where people stand on this bill, whether they've endorsed it or not. And if they've not endorsed it, you give a little button and it takes you to a page that tells you how to call and what to say to register your views, or to how to write to your congressman about your views, so that more and more congresspeople begin to see why passing this or supporting this bill becomes good politics as well as good government. And the other thing that people can do, we've got an opportunity for people to pledge not to give money to any candidate who hasn't supported the Fair Elections Now Act. Now, this idea was suggested by some very large contributors, and I think there's something, you know, quite important about what they're doing. These large contributors, you know, are people who right now have an enormous amount of power in our political system. But what they're saying is, we don't want to have that power in our political system. We want a political system where our power is just like anybody else's power. And so they want a system where they can they can no longer have the disproportionate amount of influence that they have right now, and so they want to give up their own influence like that. And I think that's a very strong testament to their integrity as citizens, as opposed to people who can leverage their influence to get good stuff. So, for example, Edgar Bronfman, who, you know, of course, has been very important in the music industry, and has been very important to him to have the power to get a congressperson on the phone or get a senator on the phone about some issue that's important to him. He's pledged to not give money to anybody who doesn't support this fundamental reform, realizing that if he had this fundamental reform, then he becomes just as important as the next guy. But he thinks our democracy needs to be fixed more than he thinks it's important for him to preserve his special access to our Congress.
Well, Larry, that's very interesting. And is there any way, as part of this process, to try to tangibly demonstrate that we've shifted the way we're giving money, that we've taken what we might have been donating before, but now we're only donating it to those that support this bill? Is there any way for that to get into the mix here, to sort of track and to even demonstrate to Congress that the way we're using our money will be different?
Well, when you take the pledge on our site, fixcongressfirst.org, what we do is we look at how much you've given in the last cycles, and then we count that as on strike. And so then you can see in your district how much money is being withheld from a candidate in that district who doesn't support fair elections. So what we've got is a system to make it quite tangible how much it costs somebody not to be on the side of this kind of reform. And so I think that's one first step to begin to create the kind of pressure necessary to get people to pay attention to this issue, and hopefully eventually to do the right thing.
Well, very, very interesting. And so what's your sense, Larry? I mean, I've got to imagine on Zoom, do we go out to the big picture and we talk about the realities of the system and we're describing here and we're talking about the up close and personal here too, and we're talking about our senators and Congress people. What's your sense of the response out there to this in Congress and in the Senate?
Well, in the Congress, there's a very large amount of effectively bipartisan support, as members, you know, both are tired of a life where they spend such an enormous amount of time raising money rather than doing what they thought they were going to do when they went to Congress.
Yeah.
And also from members who, you know, frankly don't like the current system where their integrity can so easily be drawn into doubt, right? So, for example, there was a vote that actually just happened on the 19th of May, which was to create limits to on interest groups. I think we were talking about something like this before. And this was it was an amendment to in the Senate to create a cap on interest groups that would be quite important in some states where the interest amounts are extraordinarily high. And the senators who voted to block that amendment received about 130% more in contributions from the interest groups that opposed that than senators who voted to support the amendment. Now, any average American looks at that difference and they say, well, the reason you did what you did was because of the money. And maybe that was true for some of them, but for some of them, maybe this is just what they believed. And for those of them who did this just because that's what they believe, they're insulted by the suggestion that they did what they did because of the money. Well, the only way for them to get rid of that constant cynicism and that constant view that what they're doing for the money is for them to change the system so that nobody could think that way about them. And so many members in the House want this change because they believe that if they got this change, people would begin to listen to them on the merits as opposed to listen to them listening for anything that might suggest that there was money guiding their results. So I think that's actually explaining a lot of the reason why there's strong support in the House. In the Senate, of course, people recognize it's almost impossible to get major reform through that body without a sustained and public national campaign. And so there hasn't been as much pressure in the Senate to get this on the table. Although the co-sponsor in the Senate, the lead sponsor, Senator Durbin, of course, is the second most powerful man in the United States Senate, and he very strongly believes in this issue. So there's now 21 co-sponsors in the Senate, including Senator Durbin. And our view is that if we can win it in the House, we can put a lot of pressure on members in the Senate to begin to join much more extensively. And that would be a very, very important gain in getting this prime to be passed.
Well, Larry, very, very interesting, very, very important. And I can hear the music coming in on this, signifying a break before we get into our last segment. But let me just point people again. You've mentioned it, but let me be real clear about it. FixCongressFirst.org. I think it's a first stage of a resource base. You can begin to get more information, and contact directs your action, as Larry is describing here. But moreover, you'll see the mix of organizations and those that are contributing to the perspective and where you can get more information. Other partners in this, I've mentioned maplight.org, but opensecrets.org, the Public Citizen, Common Cause, Open Congress, Ustreet, a number of other those. You'll be able to really connect and get a better sense of this. Let me take a break. Last segment coming back. Larry Lessig, Rebooting Our Democracy, Fix Congress First. Take a break in a minute. Thanks.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's AvastoneConsulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Back here we are today, last segment, Larry Lessig. We are talking really about the underpinning, the foundations to support the kind of change that we have been talking about on Zoomed, recognizing the realities, recognizing the nature of leadership and where and how we need to put some of our action into place into the world. How do we complement our personal passions with the issues and how might that come together? Larry, on this, let's make this even more tangible as we go on here. And I'm curious about this, about how this can really be brought forward. Is this enough? And the energy that's at play and where it might be resisted. Say more about that. How might we actually support this? And is this enough?
Well, I think that there's a good chance we're going to get a Congress to respond to this quickly, at least the United States House. But I think many people are skeptical that that's going to create enough pressure to get Congress to adopt fundamental reform. And that's led some people, and I'm in that list, to begin to think of other more maybe radical strategies that could begin to create pressure on Congress to do something. And one of those strategies is outlined in our Constitution. It's a process by which states vote to call for a convention. And the convention would then propose amendments to the Constitution, and those amendments would have to be ratified by 38 states. And so actually, on Wednesday, the first of those resolutions was introduced in the Rhode Island state legislature by David Siegel, who's a representative from Rhode Island. And that resolution calls for Rhode Island to pass a resolution demanding that Congress hold a convention or call a convention. And our view is that, first, a convention could produce some useful amendments that would force this issue of congressional independence onto Congress. But second, even if we don't get enough states to call for a convention, the very process of calling for a convention will produce enormous pressure on Congress to do something, if only to avoid getting a convention, because they don't want a convention which they couldn't control. So many of us think that it might be a more prudent strategy after this cycle to really push hard to get states to make this call on Congress, so that Congress really has to respond in a way that addresses the fundamental concerns about how our democracy isn't working now.
And so how, just from a civil society standpoint, you know, not Democrat, not Republican, from a more nonpartisan perspective, how might those of us in our states really engage to really try to get momentum going in as many states as possible? What would you suggest there?
Well, if you go, we have a second site called callaconvention.org, and on that site we provide tools people can use to help rally in their state and get state legislatures to begin to introduce and consider these amendments that would, proposals that would force Congress to call a convention. So there are both amendments on that site that, you know, people have proposed for the convention to consider, but also there is the beginnings of organizing to get different state legislatures to, in fact, make that call for a convention. And what citizens can do is, find state legislators who are willing to introduce this proposal and to push it and to make it a cause of theirs. And then the more that we have of that, I think the more attention that would come to this alternative of having a convention to solve this problem.
And Larry, are there any patterns you're seeing about where that might be more likely, less likely, given the demographic patterns, the way our society has evolved, the makeup of groups, the levels of consciousness involved? Are there parts of the country, are there particular states? Are there any patterns that would be useful to keep in mind that we might point to and learn from?
I think that we're actually seeing strong support for this idea on both the on the far right, number one, and also on the kind of reform left. So the far right, you know, they have concerns about limiting the scope of government power generally. And on the reform left, I think, you know, there's a big concern about the way, you know, everything we've been talking about today about how money is corrupting the political process. And those are the two places where we actually have the strongest base of support right now. And so there have been a number of calls in across the country. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about calls for a convention in conservative context, and Rhode Island would be the first that's doing it, not for a conservative purpose, but for this more fundamental process, changing the process of how our Congress gets elected purpose.
Well, I think that's very helpful to bring that down to the level of influence we can have and exercising leadership more locally and at a state level. What might be expected, Larry, from resistance to this that comes out of the big money? How and where and what form might that take, and what's your sense of that, just to have that kind of on the horizon of our own visibility?
Well, I think that, you know, the big money has perfected the ability to influence inside the Beltway processes. But a convention is something that we've never seen in the history of the United States since the first convention that created the Constitution. So there's no clear process by which big money could influence that system. And so I think the opportunity is that we could begin to have at least this part of the political system step outside of the dynamic of big money. And that might be the opportunity we need to be able to get a correct answer, or at least a useful answer to these types of extraordinarily difficult questions.
Well, beautiful building blocks here. And I'm wondering, as we're kind of heading into the final few minutes here, Larry, I wonder if you could paint a picture or vision of what the possibility might be, or if you're really painting the picture of really regaining our democracy, really rebooting in a way that brings the tangibility of what you're describing to bear, but brings the sovereignty back. Can you really flesh that out? I mean, what would it really look like? We're talking about getting there, but what would the system look like to bring that kind of sovereignty back and so forth?
Well, you know, people are rational, sensible beings. They don't waste their time on things that it doesn't make sense for them to waste their time on, except maybe Twitter or things like that. But I think what that in this context means is that if they don't think that there's a reason for them to be involved in politics because they believe money buys results, they won't be involved in politics. But if we could produce a political system where people didn't believe money bought results, then more people would spend their time trying to get governments or get local politicians to do the sort of things that they want them to do, because there's a reason to waste your time doing that rather than, you know, playing baseball with your kid. And so I think that the real opportunity here is to give people a reason to invest in democracy again, because they don't have that reason right now. The vast majority of ordinary Americans, not the politically active sorts, but the vast majority of ordinary Americans look at what politics is and what Congress is and what politicians are and feel alienated because they don't recognize themselves in the extremism of the current debates, and they don't recognize the sense in investing their own time because of the perception that it's really just money that's driving the results. So I think that what we could begin to get back to is a place where democracy actually mattered. And I don't think anybody really believes anymore that we can have a modern society where there isn't an effective, functioning democracy. And we need to get back to that.
And it feels to me at the same time, it's not unlike the kinds of relationships we have with our colleagues, our work colleagues, our family, friends, that there is a foundation of trust and being able to engage in a way where you feel like the best might come out of this, even with differences, especially in the context of the world I know that we've been describing here on Zoomed, which could bring extraordinary change, extraordinary movement in terms of addressing some very complex interdependent issues. So you're really describing to me, Larry, really rebuilding the fabric of this to build a foundation that allows the differences to come to bear and be resolved in a way that brings people in comfort and legitimacy and trust in just the larger fabric of what's actually occurring. It feels very fundamental to me.
It is. It's a fundamental rebooting of what this democracy is supposed to be.
And just in terms of the flow of this, we've talked about committing to being able to be involved, to fix Congress first, the actions we can take relative to our congressmen and women. We've been talking about how we can then even make clear where our donations would be. We've made clear about how we might engage in our states and influence on this. Any suggestion that you would have, Larry, just as we're exercising our own forms of leadership and any perspectives that we might take individually and collectively to do this? Anything else that really would be rich and top of mind for us about really helping to influence, make this happen?
I think the most important thing for people to do is to begin to focus Congress's attention on this fundamental change. You know, sometimes I like to analogize this to the problem an alcoholic might face. You know, he might be losing his job, might be losing his liver, he might be losing his spouse. Those are all extremely serious problems, the most important problems a person can face in his life. But what we all know is he's not going to solve any of those problems until he solves his alcoholism first. And that's the dynamic with Congress. They've got their own kind of dependency, and they're not going to solve that dependency. They're not going to solve any of the important problems of the nation until they solve that dependency first. So it's not that that's the most important problem. It's the first problem. And we have to get people to recognize the need to solve it now so that we can get on to the other really difficult, extraordinarily important problems that we also need to solve.
Boy, that's beautifully put, that it is the first, perhaps not the only and not the biggest, but certainly the first. Larry, I'm really appreciative of you spending the time coming on. It's been a delight to have you here and have this, engage this conversation, bring it to such clarity, and most importantly, build a combination of the understanding and the action we might take, because that is our conversation here on Zoomed. Thanks so much for joining us today, Larry. I hope we can continue this. I hope we can come back on a part two here to hear some really good news and sometime down the road.
I'd like that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks a lot. Folks, I appreciate the time, the focus, the attention, the energies, and I will tell you just from reading Lawrence's work myself, Larry has really put together, there is a passion, there's an energy, and where he's talked about, there's a clarity of attention. That's really what we're trying to provide here on Zoom. That's what we're trying to do, but there is the energy embedded in it, and as we've talked about many times, it's about taking the energy, our own passion, and directing that into the issues. I think we've heard and seen a clear one today. Let's continue. Next week, more to come, and coming weeks, we'll continue this discussion and make it happen and continue to flush out what is the right thing to do in these great times. I'm John Schmidt. We're out here for today, and as I always say, work hard and enjoy. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel, and have a terrific week.